Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Nice to see you here after the lunch. I hope that there is no coffee, so our discussions would be heated enough to replace the coffee, the need of the coffee. And we have, in fact, a very interesting topic to proceed with this afternoon. It's European defense structures. For a long time, Baltics have been pretty skeptical about the possibilities of European defense structures developing. We have been pessimists of European security and defense policy, but also opponents to some extent, I would say. And now things have been changing pretty speedily. In 2016, there was sort of a breakthrough with a global strategy, new structures, like European Defense Fund. For the first time, there was a clear link between the European funding and defense structures, which was unimaginable prior to 2016. New processes, CARD, also Awaken Beauty, PESCO, and that gave some optimism for those who supported European security and defense policy to believe that probably it's a major breakthrough and things would be going smoothly and bringing us somewhere. And in fact, the developments were supported by the society. The latest surveys have demonstrated that the society, European societies in general, are very much pro the developments within the area of security and defense. And in fact, I was very much surprised, like in 2017, there was a survey published by Eurobarometer, which showed that support for the security and defense policy was in the second place after the freedom of movement. So it says something. And to discuss where European defense policy is going, does it face challenges, or probably there are no challenges, just pure optimism and good stories? We have a wonderful panel. First of all, starting with Yanis Garisons, who is a State Secretary of the Ministry of Defense at the Republic of Latvia, very experienced civil servant who worked at the ministry since 2005 and holds his current position for the 4 years. So you've seen since the beginning of 2016 how it was developing. And on my left, that's my left hand, there is another very experienced person, Mr. Slavomir Demski, who's a director of one of the most important Polish institutes or think tanks, Polish Institute of International Affairs, who has been holding this position for many, many years with some interruptions, but so you have seen as well probably the first discussions, then there was no actions, and coming back in 2016.
So you're going to say them old enough.
Yes, experienced enough to provide us with the, comments on the developments, but also your position could be very interesting because Poland, probably even more so than the Baltic countries, have been very skeptical about these developments. Maybe they are not necessary. And last but not least, on my right hand, there is Mrs. Sandra Fernandez, who is assistant professor at the University of Minho Center for the Research in Political Science, Portugal. And we've met with Sandra on a number of occasions discussing, debating the same issue. And we just spent some time last December debating the issue of strategic autonomy. What does it mean in one of the events? So I'll ask all the speakers to speak for up to 7 minutes and provide the insights about the latest developments, about the challenges and opportunities. And probably I'll, starting with Mr. Garrison's, I'll ask to cover more practical issues of these developments. As far as you're working at the Minister of Defense, you see this every day. What's happening? What challenges do you face as a civil servant? And do you have any optimism? So, Yanis, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Margarita, and good afternoon, everybody. Probably I will start explaining what defense means, because sometimes I think we're mixing defense with security policy. Defense doesn't mean talking. Defense means real capabilities, that is tanks, air defenses, actually weapons systems, people, units, basically the staff which can be engaged and can protect. That is what is actual defense means. Sometimes I think we assume that everything what we're talking and we're wishing about and putting on papers, that would be defense, but unfortunately that is not defense. And you can't fight the battle with bunches of paper, unfortunately. Therefore, I think I will talk a little bit about how we see the current process and where those challenges. I think why Baltics being skeptical, because sometimes we felt that discussion actually was not very productive, because we always, European defense was associated with something anti-American, and we developed it like anti-American. We competed not globally with those regional powers, actually growing regional powers. We tried to compete with Americans, which I think is completely, for us, Baltic states is unhealthy. And it's like, I always say, it's, you know, like you would ask to choose the kid who is better, father or mother, for Baltics. I think that it's very unhealthy. Of course, finally, we have some practical processes, and I think basically that shift is probably very historical, because indeed, as you said, the European Defense Fund, which currently allocates $50 million and euros and for current budgetary period, and there is already some processes, and happily we Latvia been trying to engage in two of those processes with two projects and to get funding. I think that is very important beginning, and as a part of PESCO and also European defense funding. We have to see, consider what will be next step, because those are only the first parts, and unfortunately in EU we have not very good record of projects continued for long time. I can, you know, remind you we had previously pooling and sharing or smart defense, and where we with those projects. Actually, I have not heard about them anymore. I think that is the biggest challenge what we're facing, and that is strategic vision. And political will. And you, as reminded how old I am in defense. When I joined previous position in 2008, I was policy director. The first discussion, and Sven remembers probably, it was about usability of battle groups. When I left after 8 years, we still discussed usability of battle groups. For 8 years, nothing happened, but there was a lot of discussions, unfortunately. I think that is biggest challenge, actually, how to put those processes in the strategic context. I think we, again, I lately was asked by journalists, Europe needs more investment in research and development. We have to be similar to Americans. And I said, that is not healthy discussion, because we are not supposed to fight with Americans. I think if you look on strategic environment, there are more and more competitors there. And we losing the dominant Western position. And I think we have to acknowledge that. And once we don't take seriously how we will ensure that Europe is able to protect ourselves, and that our main ally is United States, we will not be, I think we will have in longer time, we will have serious problems because it's not only about, you know, processes, but it's also at the end, it might come to the need to defend ourselves. And again, I want to refer with what I started. How many air defense systems Europe has? We trying to talk about European autonomy. From whom autonomy? I think we had operation in Libya was a very good example. Americans were not keen engaged in this operation, but there were no even ammunition for European countries. I'm not talking about major enablers. Therefore, I think we have to probably change our mindset of what we're trying to strive for, because I think in environment is changing, and we will have to defend ourselves, not again some imaginative, you know. Something about from imaginations, but there might be need to defend ourselves. Where are those capabilities? There's actually not much what Europe has right now. And I think Baltics are not against European defense. Baltics are against spending money on simple processes or duplicating NATO, because we have already a lot of structures, we have processes in NATO. And would it be the best way to actually to again duplicate everything? I think we have to strive, strengthen our joint capabilities. And if Europe has more, I think Americans will not object about that. I think we simply have to change mindset and talk about what we actually will do in 10 to 20 year times. How will we be able to defend ourselves? You know, about industry. If we simply invest in industry and we're not procuring ourselves that what we actually investing in. If you look, why American equipment is so good? Because they're spending enormous money and they're buying that equipment from themselves. Our strategy has been, let's invest in industry and try to sell somebody else. And that we've seen here also, that our industry thrives. If we are not buying from our industry, why we expect that somebody else will buy from us? I think basically I will end here. The issue is we have good beginning, but the issue is how we can change our strategic mindset, where we going, and who are our allies and who are our enemies.
Thank you, Yanis, very much for quite skeptical yet point of view. So you say capabilities. That's the most important.
From defense.
That's the most important thing. But the idea of CART, PESCO, was also to help European countries to develop those capabilities, or this is impossible?
Thank you very much, Margarita. Thank you, Yanis, for inviting me. Yeah. Again, that's the kind of the allies investment we should maintain. There are two types of people I deal with. I mean, PESMIT is an advisory institution, and so we are in constant relationship, let me say, with MOD and MFA. And so there are two very different types of people. MFA people are usually are keen to agree with you. And there is something, you know, wider thing we should believe in. And the process is a good an aim in itself. So we should keep kicking this kind down the road just to maintain dialogue and maintain a relationship. When I meet people from MOD, our conversation is cut very short about these introductions. And we end up very soon with, you know, conclusion that, okay, are we going to have new capabilities out of that or not? And here is important analytical question, which I believe explains to some extent the difference of approach between the Baltic countries, Poland, Romania. I mean, a time frame, a time horizon. And I, again, I would like to pick up Minister's point that we need to have a grand strategy behind. And if you think in strategic terms, the time frame and time horizon is important thing. How much time do we have? And if we take other, point for consideration, the calculus and debate in the United States about time, we realize that now they are talking, thinking, and they are adjusting themselves the perspective of 10 to 15 years. They believe that in 10 to 15 years, a kind of the clash between China and the United States may occur. And there is a strategic consequence of that, namely that if something goes wrong in Far East, that political and also a political attention of the United States, but also all the world, can be sucked by these developments there, and military capabilities may follow. Military capabilities that are now on the ground in Europe may follow as well. I don't want to go too deeply into that because there is a significant difference between this theater of operations. I mean, in Europe you need ground forces mostly. In Pacific, United States needs a navy. There is a difference, but again, the air power can be a subject of competition in such a case, and we should simply bear it in mind that we may face the situation that there would be no significant U.S. forces in Europe, and there won't be significant U.S. political / military attention to European troubles. That can be seen by some as a window of opportunity. So in that way, I'm trying to explain you the difference between the strategic preoccupation of NATO Eastern Flank / EU Eastern Flank and countries who are in much more comfortable in terms of geography position. Having said this, you know, this few words about strategic landscape, let me turn into semantics of this a panel. The title of this panel is European Defense Structures. There is an alleged Bonaparte quote that actually it's better to have one miserable plan of war than two excellent ones, which you try to implement in the same time. And I think that's exactly the way how we can describe our debate about structures, plural, structures in Europe. We have plenty of structures. We have what we are lacking on the capabilities. That's the problem. And the capabilities cannot substitute capabilities. So we could assess structures only from the point of view how you know they are efficient in producing real capabilities you can deploy on the ground in 10 to 15 years, not in very long theoretical future. So it leads me to the some concrete illustrations. And there is, of course, I would like to mention Pascal and Cart. Pascal, to me, is unfortunately a main framework for industrial and military cooperation, which is needed in the long run and may produce some capabilities in the long run. But they cannot be deployed in 10 to 15 years. So that's the issue for MFA, not for MOD. That's the conclusion rational politicians in any country in this part of the world would take. However, it's good. It's perfect. We can work on it. And the last thing about CART, the decision to enter to this cooperation should be made on the grounds of national analysis. That's the main point. So there is this verification mechanism. So it should not be seen as an instrument, to impose a kind of the wisdom on other nations and force them to do something. Last thought on that. Thinking about capabilities, we are also having in mind, from whom we can buy it. If you are sitting in the place where we are, it doesn't matter from whom you are buying. It matters what kind of these capabilities, what you can do with these capabilities and how you could enhance your defense posture. That's what matters. So from our point of view, if there are, US capabilities on the market and there is no competition on European side, the choice is very clear. Of course, European can do that something in this regard. If we can create funds we could use to enhance our military capabilities to protect our people in 10 to 50 years using European funds, we should do that. Yes, I understand there is some criticism and objections to this way of thinking, but it could be a subject of further discussion of this panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Slavomir, for bringing this twofold vision of CSDP, the strong sides and weak sides. And there are two visions, MFA vision and MOD vision. But then at the end of the day, anyways, it is about the capabilities. And I was just wondering, there is a big debate that it's not that Europeans do not invest into defense. They spend one-third of what the U.S. is spending. The problem is a lack of coordination and inability to win from the economy of scales and conflicting interests. So it's not, the capabilities as such as a problem, but more the politics is the problem. And now I want to turn to Sandra. So there is this ambition to have the strategic autonomy. And as Slavomir mentioned, there are at least two different visions of CSDP or strategic autonomy in every country, MFA and MOD. And we have 28 countries with various visions. So what does strategic autonomy mean? And then if you could elaborate a bit on Portuguese perspective as well later on. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for this invitation. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here and to share the panel with distinguished figures that know much more than I know about this on the field. So I'm learning a lot as well. Thank you very much for that. Actually, when I was invited for the panel, I was gathering my ideas, what could I say that could be meaningful and also helpful in a reflection on today's developments on defense structures. And I was also caught by the term structures. What does it mean really when we think about European defense? So basically, I gathered my thoughts of last year because I was so enthusiastic, I think, as everyone, about this brave new world of European defense, particularly in the aftermath of the PESCO project's approval. And last year, my focus was pretty much about capabilities and the cyber or digital spheres. And I have to say that today, with the changing environment, we have the consolidation of the Trump administration isolationism, protectionism. We have the Brexit conundrum. And because of that, my attention is back to much more foundational questions. So my focus as an analyst is not accompanying exactly the capabilities progression in that field, but about, as Yanis just focused, about more foundational issues. What is the whole EU defense endeavor about? And I think this is a question that today needs some answer. Just a note on NATO. I met last week a former ambassador of Obama, and he was saying to me that, yes, NATO has internal problems, it's true, but the US has to understand that NATO is very important. It is there to protect Europe because it protects the United States. And I'm not sure that this understanding is valid anymore today. And this is why, and I think we all share probably this view, that this is one of the main explanations why the EU developments have been boosted. We are witnessing this brave new world of European defense developments because we have this change on the other side of the Atlantic. But I don't think it's enough to think today about European defense. I think that we have to look at the European integration process by itself. And it has been built on a serious compromise towards peace building. So the EU construction is about peace, building peace. Of course, it was a different historical context. We had extreme nationalism, so different from today. No. We had war, and of course, we had a context of ending with colonialism. And something very important has been added to this endeavor of building peace. It's all about the human security perspective. In the 90s, the evolution of international security has brought human security as a main focus, and the EU's external engagement has embraced this. I recall that if human security is a doctrine for the European Union, it means that not only peace but also human security is a driver for the EU's defense. And human security means that human rights are at the center of all military action. So the focus is really different from a traditional perspective of security. And I would like to bring to a more conceptual reflection on that the contribution that is not so new anymore but still valid, the Mary Calder view on new wars. And she recalled thus that a war or conflict, violence today is about four interrelated aspects. We need to know who are the actors of the conflicts, their goals, their methods, and the way they finance themselves. And I think that if the EU doesn't make this internal reflection of what are the conflicts, the violence that the EU wants to tackle, we will not get anywhere from there. So the brave new world narrative about EU defense, I think, is not only about internal developments of the EU, but it's also about understanding the transformation of war violence. And this calls for a deep rethinking that I think we are not tackling today at the EU level. That because in my sense, old visions still prevail over new realities. And when I say old visions, I say state-centered visions. Coming to Portugal, as you kindly requested, what is the position of Portugal? Actually, I was commenting over lunch that it's a pleasure for me to travel here to the Baltic area because we share a lot in terms of our vision about what is security and defense. The EU-NATO interrelation is like a core commitment for Portugal as it is for Latvia, for instance. And by coincidence, I had the pleasure to have dinner last week with our Minister of Defense, so I'm very updated about what is the current position of the Portuguese government in terms of European defense structures. And he was mentioning to me, I was asking, and he was mentioning that he thinks that the level of governance on defense in the EU has improved lately because there is more solidarity and cooperation, so there is this acknowledgement. But he also senses that this is a moment now to develop military power as well, because soft power is not enough anymore. So this is clear for a country as Portugal. Concerning the European army, I also asked him some questions to be able to share them with you today. He told me that he has a perception that this European army ID is not rooted in the European societies, meaning that the national reference is very important for national identity, and he thinks that it is underestimated in the ongoing debates about what is a European army. Although Portugal is very supportive of the ID, but he thinks that the ID is absolutely not defined yet. So I think that when we think today about the European defense structures, the problem is that the countries have a lot of problems selling to their audience that it's worth investing in it. Why? Because the costs, financial costs, but also the idea of the loss of lives, which is implied in this area, are not easy to be sold to the audience because the results are not there. And I go back to my new wars definition. Results are not there, probably because we need to look back at what is violence today, what are conflicts today. And also I think that if I look at Portugal as a country, and I think it's not only for Portugal, it's true for other EU member states, there is a strong sense in Portugal that it is not the EU that at the end of the day will provide security for the country. So this is still a major problem to advance further. So concerning strategic autonomy per se, I will join what Janice just said about strategic autonomy. It's not from the United States, from something, it's for something. So it's strategic autonomy for a specific goal. And my answer to that is that strategic autonomy of the EU should mean that it is for what? For dual capacity of our capabilities. So I think that our instruments in defense have to serve two objectives at the same time, military but also humanitarian and civilian goals. Because the new wars, new conflicts, are very mixed in terms of what it is. War is not anymore about gaining war. It's about protecting. And I think that this is the way forward. By the way, the European, the Portuguese Parliament is discussing right now, at the moment, today, the financing of defense capabilities for the next 12 years. And basically, two-thirds of the capabilities that will be financed is about renewing what we already have, and one-third is for dual-use equipments and instruments. So it goes in this sense. So to conclude, I would say that I would agree that the EU needs more ambition, but it's difficult to be ambition, to have ambition in difficult times. And coming back to your initial comment, Margarita, to pass the word to me, I would say that Portugal and the member states do not necessarily need to invest more; they need to invest better. I think this would be my bottom line.
Thank you, Sandra, very much, and also for bringing this philosophical discussion that, you know, any capabilities should be built on certain understanding of threats. And I believe that the different understandings of threats in various European countries could be the thing that is hampering ability to agree, because threats on the east flank and on the southern flank might differ not only in their essence, but what kind of capability this would be needed to conquer them. But without further ado, because time's running, I'd like to open the panel for the questions. And yes, please. Could you please introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Tony Brenton. I'm a former British ambassador to Russia. And I'm going to say what you would expect me to say, which is that Europe is playing with fire here. We are about to leave the EU, and we have been the principal obstacle within the EU to all sorts of magnificently grandiloquent discussions of the European army and all of that stuff. And the reason why we've been so firmly opposed is because we know Washington like the backs of our hands. The Americans will watch this discussion. They will say the Europeans don't care about NATO anymore, therefore why should we? And we would be substantially lowering our security possibly very soon. Remember Europe's earlier excursions into this area. Remember now is the hour of Europe back in Bosnia and the humiliation that followed that. Remember the Kosovo operation where we couldn't get a plane off the ground without US radar and other support. I am very worried. I mean, we're leaving, so we're out of
this. You don't care.
Well, we do care, of course, and that's why I'm being so clear now. We do care. And I hear all this reference to human security and worry about human rights and all of that. That, to me, is important, but secondary. Yep. What our defence is about defending our security. And I see a very real danger that in an EU without the UK, rhetoric will take over, and that will weaken our real source of security, which is in Washington.
So you don't believe that there is a possibility of development of EU defence structures along with NATO?
I've worked a lot in the EU. And I see a very, always, I mean, the EU is a great organisation, I'm rather sad we're leaving, but there's always a huge gap between what the EU actually does on the ground and the rhetoric that goes with it. And this is an area where the rhetoric is calculated to turn every American four-star general off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So now I'd like to ask the panellists to react. I don't know, Yanis is already raising the hand, and then we'll come back to Sven.
Well, I think the problem with European defences is that during the last 20 years it has been depleted completely. And you can, of course, play with different kind of cooperation models and things like that. But, you know, I went through the cutting of budget by 50%, now actually by growing budget. And the problem is you can't actually increase capabilities or develop capabilities in 1 or 2 years. It takes 5-10 years to develop actually defense capabilities. And once you're starting talking about, you know, fancy things, they will be somewhere, but you need basically basic stuff. And one you don't, you know, of course you can say we can cooperate better in Europe, but then, fine, then what does it mean for Europe? In military planning, it would mean that all forces have to be stationed around the borders or some air defense in between, protecting the main cities, the main infrastructure, and that would be in counting whole EU area as a defense plan, as defense planners would mean. There are still, you know, I think it's wrong actually to say that Europe spends more but the efficiency less as the United States. Europe is not a single state. Let's start from that. And I think the problem is there is a depletion of capabilities in majority of EU states, and it will take long time to build those capabilities. I'm not, on my comment on the EU army, I think there's also a misperception, probably you already alluded to that. I would say my understanding is that public support is for something like army of missionaries in Brussels and financed by EU funds. That's what actually public wants. Probably and the support. If you ask people on the streets of Riga whether they are ready to give authority to the president of EU to send our forces, I don't know where, I would guarantee you the answer will be no.
It always depends on the question you ask.
But actually, European army means that the EU structures will send our forces somewhere. And I'm even not elaborated the situation if we are attacked and who will protect us.
Slava, do you want to?
Very briefly, I can't agree more with Mr. Ambassador on that. As you know, if you talk to Americans and if you cooperate with them closely, you realize that you know there are simply no-go zones in this European debate. It means that if we spend our time of connecting dots in our European defense policy, we invite trouble of building or widening the gap between US and Europe. And the problem we have in Europe is that actually there are so many different views what for we need our defense policy. There are a lot of proponents of thinking that actually we need our defense policy to help our military to help our military industry to grow up, bridge development gap with the US, and after that compete with them on equal basis. We do have these problems also on national level, and there is a continuous debate in our countries how we should use our defense budget. There are a lot of actors who believe that actually we should procure from our national industry to help them, to enhance them, and they always clash with those people who are more preoccupied with strategic thinking and real capabilities. Because if we need to help our industry, there should be separate fund and separate budget to do that. And actually, that could be a kind of the hint for European Union that we should not use our military procurement to help our industry. That's another policy. That's industrial policy. If we need them, let's go in this direction and allocate adequate money on that. But we should not mix both industrial policy with our defense policy. Defense policy is to protect our people with the hard capabilities on the ground.
I think that PESCO is very much about, not only developing capabilities, but also introducing this concept, produce European and buy European, and that was one of the one of the areas where some disagreements between the EU and US actually rose. Because U.S. have been fearing that at some point European countries would be forced to buy only American equipment, European equipment. Sandra.
Yes, just a few words. Thank you so much for this very challenging position that I will challenge myself back. I will answer with another question. Is really the so you say that so human security is important but secondary because our real source of security is in Washington. I would answer with another question. Is really this source of security, has really this source of security provided so much stability and peace in the very important theaters of operation in close to Europe and outside of Europe? What are the results of that? Are we successful? Are we winning something on the ground? And I have a lot of doubts about that. I would tend to agree with you in the sense that the Russian issue is a specific one, and Europeans should not be very naive about that, and have to complement the U.S. on that. But I don't think it's an either or question. Like there is something that is primary, and there is something that is secondary. Because I think that if we take security on a global scale, and we look, for instance, at Syria or at Libya, I'm not sure that you solve the post-conflict situations with traditional military force. And additionally, you were talking, I was recalling the morning panel that was really much focused on the EU values, EU values, EU values. And I think that externally, the EU has also to stand for its values. And human security is really part about the EU values as a player internally and externally. So it's really a thinking out of the box about what is security, not because it's fancy, it's because I'm an academic and I like it, it's because I think that the real world now is not the world that we had before. And yesterday was the anniversary of NATO, and I was looking at it, and honestly, part of it looked so much as history for me.
I think, Sandra, your remark brings us...
Hello, Alessandra, but...
There was the question, what are we ready to die for? So are we ready to die for the values?
And the European Union?
No, for the values. And what kind of values that those could be? So is liberal democracy a value, or liberal values are important for us? Are those values are important? And I think it's in this world, it is becoming more and more important. Sven. And can I ask to ask the questions, three questions in a row, and we'll respond because the time's running. So Sven and then two colleagues.
Thank you. Thank you, Margarita. One German researcher very nicely put it last year, that those people who talk about European strategic autonomy and European army do not really mean it. And they talk it because by that they can bask in the glory of being a good European. This is an aspirational idea, not to be reached, but the goal is to speak about it. It is not very well defined. It's like Brexit in 2016. Because if you don't define things, you can actually get 52%. No one knows what it is, and everyone can then project their desires or fears on something which is not defined. Now, if we actually look at the two issues, the two concepts, the strategic autonomy and the European army, and I would say actually the strategic autonomy can be conceptualized, but does not mean that we should that I agree with all the points in that, but it's kind of, it means something. So what is usually meant by that is that Europe wants to be autonomous in its decision-making, in its capabilities, and it's a military industrial base and R&D and so forth, and three pillars. Now, unfortunately, there is no fourth pillar, which is actually underlying all that, and this is actually a defense investment. Without what, you do not have capabilities, you do not have military industrial base, and because you don't have capabilities, you do not make decisions because you don't have a ways to implement that. So actually, we are getting back to the issue of a missing 100 billion euros from the European aggregate defense budgets. That's basically the additional money on European defense if all EU member states, or if all NATO member states in Europe would fulfill the 2% pledge. I totally echo what Anthony said previously about how this debate is viewed in Washington, D.C., especially by one person who does not like international commitments, does not like NATO, does not like Europe, does not like specifically Germany for some reason, I have no idea why. And of course, one day we can wake up to the tweet, which basically says that, well, you want to be autonomous, please go ahead. Thank you very much. Has been a pleasure being here in Europe. Now, since I have no idea what European army means, I think Sandra has said that there is a strong support in Portugal to European army. So what are the Portuguese people supporting? Mm-hmm. What is the thing that they support?
Okay, thank you, Sven. So we'll start with Sandra probably with the last question. Oh, I said that we're going to go through the questions. Let's go because we don't have much time. That's going to...
Okay.
Sandra.
Sorry.
Yeah, let's go. Sorry. Sorry.
Yes, thank you. I'm Elina Egle. I'm from Federation of Security and Defense Industries of Latvia. So the industries have been mentioned several times, and I think we still have to have a little bit more of this industry perspective, because even my colleague said that there's no industrial capabilities in Europe. I wouldn't say so. I think when we are, we also have to probably understand that industries are also changing. So we cannot talk anymore about companies which are state-owned, working for very concrete military requirements, and that's it. So basically right now, if we are looking for on a defense market, then we see that, for instance, one of the top three largest companies like Biosystems, it's not American, it's not, it's basically fund owned, majority is Sweden, it's US, it's UK. So we are interconnected. And I think this is a century of interconnectivity. And in our case, for industries, it's very important to understand what are the needs of our customers in this case. What are the areas where the investment would be required, where companies can invest and put in R&D, what kind of things we have to do to really be proactive and to support and supply security, especially understanding that it's not only conventional, but there are a lot of hybrid aspects. So I think that I think that there was a question about understanding the world of violence today. I think that there is also deeper knowledge probably necessary about the industries as such, because we are interconnected and also depending on each other.
Far as I understood, this was a remark, not a question.
Hi, I'm a former Latvian ambassador, Jānis Eichmanns. Sven may have answered my question, but I will put this anyway. And this goes to our dear colleague's point of view, and that is, if I'm not mistaken, both Merkel and Macron have supported the idea of a European army. Anybody disagreeing with that?
Yes. No.
Yes, no.
Merkel rejected it.
The Germans are talking about army of the Europeans.
Then my question is, that sounds to me like strategic stupidity.
Yes.
Strategic stupidity. So explain to me how, if there are leaders in Europe who support this, knowing, and if they don't know, they probably shouldn't be leaders of the countries they're in. The American point of view, I haven't talked to the generals in Washington or anybody else. How can they make those kind of statements in support of something? And I did a paper for the ministry on all this. and you haven't even touched upon that there are four different kind of possibilities for a European army. But okay. And I have myself been ambassador to NATO, and I have talked to those same kind of folks in the United States, and I can agree with you that they are watching this kind of debate, and they are looking at the kind of decisions that Europe is making. And I really don't understand, and maybe I'm being a little too nasty or hostile, but strategic stupidity is, you know.
You asked to comment on the strategic stupidity. I think that there's been quite a lot of strategic stupidities on both parts of the Atlantic recently. So, and this is, I guess, one of the reasons why, you know, one strategic stupidity is being put against another strategic stupidity. So I agree with you very much that, you know, strategic stupidity is at some point a big, big challenge for better relations within the transatlantic community, but also could hamper European security. But now we do not have much time. We have several questions, several remarks, and we start with Sandra this time.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for bringing the business model logic of the development of the industry. I think that would be a useful, a very practical way of looking at strategic autonomy, thinking about the business model, because at the end of the day, the financial aspect is really a leading one in those issues as well. Sven, concerning, well, how come Portugal supports this European army if right now... Okay. So, as everything in the EU, Portuguese society in general does not support specificities. This is the idea. So, supporting the idea that Portugal is a front runner, a good student of the EU initiatives, be it on the economic side, be it on the security and defense side. As long as it goes hand in hand with NATO. So, as long as it's not against or from, it's okay. That's the idea. Last year, when PESCO was approved in the Portuguese Parliament, there was a small problem, let's say, but it has nothing to do with the ID, it has to do with internal politics. Basically, the coalition small parties that are more skeptical about the EU, but they are not a majority, wanted a clear definition that PESCO is not about the European Army, but it's not really representative of the whole position of Portugal. So it's not because we know exactly what it will be about, it's because we will be part of the group. That is what is important for a country as Portugal.
Are you satisfied?
Not really.
Not really. Can we continue, or do you want to comment on something else?
No,
but
okay.
Just very
no,
okay. Okay. So we'll go to Slavomir, strategic stupidity.
No, I'm not going to comment on strategic stupidity. I think 2 points or 3 points I would like to offer you in the end. First, about the European Army. I have my own litmus paper, which I used for this kind of initiative in Europe. Because first, we need additional capabilities, European capabilities on the ground. No question about it. Second, there are countries who do have in Europe some capabilities that may be Europeanized. European Army, when I see the term or heard the term, it could be something like European External Action Service. Yes. And actually, there is a country in Europe which does have such units. And it's France. They have the Foreign League. So if France is serious about European Army, they would allow this Foreign League to be subordinated to some European command. But they are not going to do that. And the same with nuclear capabilities. Because in the end of the day, if we think about credible deterrence, we rest on nuclear capabilities. Because that's our West strategy to respond to any kind of aggression on us, that we could escalate to the level of nuclear conflict. And again, France is not willing, not considering, not deliberating about that. And I understand for the reasons. And the third point is about this cooperation of European industry. Well, there are three cases which are quite telling for me. You know, we are talking about buying European sometimes. And there are two countries who are, very keen to speak on behalf of Europe. And if we look carefully enough, they are the leaders of European, approach. In the end of the day, I have a feeling, and I can prove that, they are thinking about making a European market for themselves. That's the main project. And two cases. The fifth generation fighter, Franco-German project. And they don't want Italians to join in. Thank you very much. Another case, European tank, next generation European tank, Franco-German initiative, and they don't want Poland to join in. And Poland, which actually does have the biggest tank army in Europe now. So that's very true. And the last, PESCO thing, the highest aspiration of this initiative is to have common European drone, like a Predator. I mean, so that's the level of aspiration. We can create the drones, but serious business like fifth generation fighter or tank, it's not it shouldn't be too much European. So actually, if you are in Ministry of Defense in Poland, or Ministry of Finance, you don't have much option left. Go to Americans, because you know there is a 10 to 15 years you need to spend your money and to prepare yourself. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Slavomir, and directly to Yanis.
Yes, I probably, you know, responding to all those comments, I think what is what you have to ask always when those discussions are happening, and the main our goal is deterrence. How you will deter and how you will be, whether you will be important. And I think on the case of the European Union, already we've seen on several occasions, because of lack of military power, we've seen that the EU has been simply disregarded by many actors. And I think, unfortunately, that has not been drawing any attention or changes in general perception of defense in general European Union. And when, of course, then it brings me to 2% issue, because it's not all, again, we can invent new smart defense too, we can invent everything, but the money is needed actually to buy something, invent something, because when you start inventing, you need ammunition to train, you need people. It's actually, even if you create joint unit, it will not cost at the end you less, because you have to go, we will go then to Estonia training, it will be much more expensive to go there as actually to create itself on our own. Therefore, and that I think is very, I'm sorry that we actually in this discussion, we recognize that basically European Union increasing its defense spending because of President Trump. We are not, because you know the environment changing, and we have not recognized that there is, the world is changing. And I agree with you that basically there is a new concept of war. We have to discuss it, but we, because of Trump. But I, you know, you named me many years ago. I remember all previous administrations. Actually, they insisted on the increase of defense spending, but they were very polite. They were very polite, and they were not happy with European defense.
Even Obama administration
actually, they insisted on increasing spending, but they were not so, how to put it, insisted. And now to say that we suddenly doing something because of and that I think feel sorry, because we have to feel you know, we have to do it because ours, you know, it's our need. We have to protect our people, not because somebody in Washington, and there will not be deterrence without capabilities. And again, on industry, I think you know, there are two perspectives. One, of course, they always this European industry trying to centralize, and I think Baltics is why Baltics is different, because it's a Suwalki gap, you know, so, and there's operational need to have the ability to produce basic things and maintain the force and operate this force, even if this gap is closing. Therefore, we need it, and that goes, of course, in contradiction with general trend to centralize and invent one industry, and everybody buys from one industry. That, I think, is our big challenge from here, because I again always refer to 1940, when we ordered a lot and paid already, and never been delivered that equipment, because and I don't see that currently, if that gap closes, how we will be maintained if we don't have some basic industry. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Yanis, very much, and thank others. I think that we didn't manage to solve the problem, but it takes time, it takes a lot of discussions. And I just remember that the whole history of European Union is going through the various crises, and each crisis brings some value added. And I was just wondering, I mean, what kind of crisis should, you know, shatter European Union that it would take decisions to invest more and to cooperate more? But that's probably for the next discussion, or China and Russia combined, it could be as well. But let's thank our wonderful speakers and wish you what? Great to have a great weekend. Yeah, it's weekend. It's Friday. Yeah, it's Friday.
Yeah, we have a panel, the national
panel.
Yeah.
There's another panel.
I'm sorry. Yeah, after this panel.